From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Britain's Sunday Times has leaked a government document outlining the worst-case scenario in case of a no-deal Brexit with the European Union. The document was apparently compiled by the Cabinet Office and named Operation Yellow Hammer. It concludes that there would be catastrophic damage to Britain's economy and infrastructure in the weeks and months following a hard exit. European Union officials have already rejected Prime Minister Boris Johnson's appeal to revisit his predecessor Theresa May's negotiations for a Brexit deal. The deadline to negotiate a deal or leave without one is the end of October. My guest is Luke Reeder. He teaches in the Department of History at Case Western University in Cleveland, Ohio. He's been writing about Brexit. Welcome to the program, Luke.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's begin by talking about this document. Right away, Brexit proponents suggested that this was deliberately leaked to try to thwart Boris Johnson's negotiations and his ability to negotiate properly with the EU. What do you think?
I think whether it was leaked or not deliberately is a bit of a red herring, really. I mean, what the document lays out is actually a fairly sober assessment of what government civil servants who are in the UK impartial think is the likely outcome of a no-deal Brexit. So this isn't the worst-case scenario. It's not the best-case scenario. It's somewhere in the middle. Something that is likely to happen. So I think worrying about who leaked it is far less important than worrying about what the document suggests.
So if this is not a worst case scenario, the worst case scenario could be even more appalling, because we're talking about a situation where you would have fresh food supplies could be impacted, products that people rely on, ingredients and chemicals and packaging, and even, of course, import and export. The ability of Britain to import and export is going to be very deeply impacted if Britain just leaves without a deal. Shouldn't such a document be public knowledge? I mean, it shouldn't have been leaked, right? If these are the sober consequences, the middle of the road likely consequences, shouldn't this have already been public?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very good case for making this type of planning public information anyway. One could speculate as to why the government chose not to. And this is probably a government decision as opposed to a civil service decision.
The British people deserve to know what's at stake, right?
Yeah.
Could happen to them?
Yeah, and this, what this document shows is that different groups of people will be hit in different ways. Things like interruptions in the supply of food or interruptions in the supply of medicine. They'll hurt the economically vulnerable, the chronically ill, much more than they will wealthier members of society. Some types of food shortages, but there may well be price increases as well, which means people will have less access to food, which puts pressure on things like food banks, things like supermarkets to actually sort of get the supply onto the shelves quickly enough.
Now, when Johnson basically started as the UK's new prime minister, what changed about Brexit negotiations? I understand that funding that was not available to even study the issue and to further negotiations suddenly became available when Johnson became prime minister.
Right. Some of this money is money that's been lying about. Some are sort of lying about and wasn't allocated previously. Some of it is re-announced spending where, governments in the past has allocated money for something, and then they go back and announce that the allocation has been applied. So you effectively get to say twice that you're spending money. That's quite a favorite tactic of governments in the UK. Both Labour and the Conservatives do it regularly. So there's that. There's, you know, there's deficit spending. You know, there's Britain's historically run a large national debt, and £2 billion here or there doesn't actually make that much of a difference. I think the fact the government realizes it has to allocate money is a positive. Whether it's allocating money effectively enough, and whether allocating money just shy of 2 months before Britain could leave the European Union in a catastrophic manner, whether that's helpful or not, is another question. This is money that should have been allocated months, if not years ago.
Right. I mean, if this money had been allocated during Theresa May's leadership, it might have turned out differently. Of course, May is, I understand, quite deserving of the blame that she gets for really screwing up Brexit negotiations herself and not taking enough of a leadership position. What do you think could have happened had this money been allocated while she was still prime minister?
I mean, I think the real, even sort of going beyond the money, I think the real problem was issuing Article 50 without having any sort of real plan worked out about how negotiations would be carried out, what Britain was looking for. Britain effectively went in, with the expectation that the European Union wouldn't stand together, that they'd be able to divide different members of the European Union.
And remind our audience what Article 50 is.
Article 50 is the mechanism by which a country begins the process of leaving.
It's a very short clause in the treaty that outlined the European Union, right?
Yeah, exactly. It triggers a leaving mechanism, which is supposed to take 2 years unless members in the leaving party agree that it should take longer. To be fair to the government, they're in a bind where if they allocate money if they allocate money against the negative consequences of Brexit, then they're saying that Brexit has negative consequences, which alienates the part of their support that likes Brexit. If they don't, then they alienate the support who thinks they're sort of being cavalier. So the government, in effect, boxed itself into a corner by not being able to agree a sort of common strategy, or by Theresa May's decision to call an election in 2017 didn't help either, where the government lost an effective majority in Parliament and had to govern essentially with the help of a very small party in Northern Ireland.
So what does Boris Johnson think he can do to convince EU leaders to do that Theresa May couldn't?
I mean, figuring out what Boris Johnson wants to do is quite difficult. I think he has in mind one of two scenarios, one of which is to try and negotiate with the European Union, to say he's negotiating in good faith, irrespective of whether he is or not, and then to come back to the UK Parliament and to say to the Parliament, look, I negotiated with the EU. I couldn't get anything done either. This is because of EU intransigence. He has the support in the press, in the media. He has enough of a media background. He was one of the people who made the popular case for Britain leaving the EU in the first place. That could be a compelling argument. The second part of it would be to say, look, I negotiated with the European Union. I've tried to get this through Parliament. Parliament is stopping me, and the EU is stopping me. We need an election so that the country can elect a government that will effectively push through a no deal. The country will elect a new government that is committed to the idea of a no deal exit. He can argue that the Parliament, as it stands, is committed to some kind of deal. Instead, they want a clean, you hear the phrase sort of clean break bandied about, which, you know, this wouldn't be a clean break, but it would be a very clear severing of links between Britain and the EU.
So even though you have a pretty grim assessment of what would happen if Britain leaves the EU without a deal in place to govern trade and relations between the two nations, Johnson, the current prime minister, seems to want just that.
Yeah, I mean, there does seem to be a serious belief. That's sort of begun to take hold in, you know, different parts of the Conservative Party, especially that I think with some seriousness, people do believe that the consequences of Brexit are over exaggerated, you know, based on the argument that the British economy slowed down, but people didn't see much of a difference economically after Britain made the decision to leave in 2016. You know, there is a thought amongst some that this will be that the effects are over-exaggerated. There's a desire among some for economic damage because they believe that, you know, you can rebuild and reshape the British economy in the decades to come. So there's sort of multiple ideological explanations for a desire for no Brexit. There's, you know, a principal desire on some for just a clean break. And, you know, this is a sort of very old cadre of Eurosceptics who believe that the EU impinges on the UK sovereignty and that the only way to solve this is for Britain to leave. So you've got different interest groups sort of coming together in the Conservative Party. You've also got pressure from the right, from Nigel Farage's Brexit Party, which is agitating to leave on the 31st of October. You know, they feel betrayed. They feel that the results of the referendum haven't been adhered to, and many Conservative MPs fear a challenge from their right and their constituencies if there is an election. So you've got a whole range of pressures on Boris Johnson, and he's figuring out how to work it through. He could end up in a number of different scenarios: a no deal or a renegotiated version of Theresa May's plan that was agreed with the European Union, that he then tries to sell to the country as something new, which he could possibly do.
Explain what the so-called Irish backstop aspect of these negotiations is, and what role that plays in negotiating a Brexit deal.
Right, so the Irish backstop's basically a sort of complicated system of agreements whereby whereby there's a customs agreement between the EU and the UK on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. This would be the only land border between Britain and the EU that would exist. And so what that agreement does is it keeps Northern Ireland and effectively the rest of the UK in a customs agreement with the European Union until such a time as it's presumed, you know, until such a time as it's agreed that there's sufficient protection, sufficient regulatory alignment, or sufficient agreements on the border between the two countries. So for people who are skeptical of EU membership, this is seen as a kind of fifth column, a kind of way in which Britain will always be tied to Europe. For those who want Britain to remain in the EU, this is seen as not a close enough arrangement, that you get none of the benefits of EU membership and all of the obligations being that the UK has to sign up still to EU legislation, EU regulations, without being a full member of the single market.
What is the public sentiment as all of this is playing out? You mentioned that Johnson is getting ready to possibly call for a new election so that he gets a majority in Parliament. Labour's Jeremy Corbyn has already begun campaigning for a general election, calling Boris Johnson the UK's Trump. And it seems as though there is a potentially growing appetite among the public to remain in the EU, or and have there been polls showing one way or another what the public sentiment is on Brexit?
Yeah, it's begun to shift slightly. The polls tend to show a roughly 55, 45 split, 55 for Remain, 45 for Leave, which is just outside of the margin of error. But given that in early 2016, the Remain campaign was up to 20 points ahead of the Leave campaign, it's a lead that Remain supporters would be anxious about. There is, I think, sort of gradual movement to, towards the Remain position, but it's been very slow over the last few years. There's a large number of people just want this resolved in one way or another. There's sort of political divisions that seem to be emerging in the UK, whereby traditional political identifiers, whether it be Conservative, Labour, Liberal Democrat, Scottish Nationalist, are dissolving. Instead, sort of people are identifying politically as Remainers and Leavers. So it is leading to some kind of political alignment. What that means for a general election is unclear. The Remain votes split across several different parties. The vote for supporters to leave is basically concentrated in the Conservative Party and the Brexit Party. So, there would be an element of a calculated risk in calling a general election. You could have a very hung parliament, but given the peculiarities of the British electoral system, you could have the Conservatives with a 100-seat majority on maybe 25, 26% of the vote, or you could have a parliament where there's a number of different parties with between 20 and 100 or so seats. So.
What is the what is at stake in terms of immigration when it comes to Brexit? Because a lot of the backers of Brexit were very openly anti-immigrant, and the idea of refugees entering through one part of Europe and making their way to Britain was, I understand, in part a sentiment that they relied on to in the vote on Brexit.
Yeah, there's a lot at stake here. On Monday it appeared as though Boris Johnson was beginning to sort of use the status of EU citizens or people migrating to the UK as a kind of bargaining chip. He mentioned that freedom of movement between the UK and the rest of the EU would end the moment Britain leaves the European Union, which is a new, this is an argument that hasn't really been used before. So there's a lot at stake here.
And let me
There's a
actually
lot.
quote what he said. He said, "Freedom of movement as it currently stands will end on October 31st when the UK leaves the EU. For example, we will introduce immediately much tougher criminality rules for people entering the UK. Details of other changes immediately on October 3rd for a new immigration plan are currently being developed." And then he sort of left the rest of it vague. But this quote makes the case, the greater case that that he indeed is the UK's Trump. This idea that there are the implication that criminal immigrants are entering the UK as a way to make his case for Brexit is a Trumpian idea.
Yes, and it's rather startling as well, given that just 5 or 6 years ago he was boasting about how pro-immigrant he was as mayor of London, and how he was one of the few British politicians to actively make a case for the benefits of immigration. This is quite a startling turnaround in less than just over half a decade. So, yeah, there's a lot at stake for immigrants. There's a lot at st I mean, we've already seen rises. We saw rises in hate crimes following the immediate Brexit vote in the UK in 2016. We've seen upsurges again and again. So, yeah, there's a lot at stake for immigrants who are feeling beleaguered, who are feeling as though they're being used by the government as a bargaining chip. And to be honest, there's a lot at stake for British immigrants in the rest of the European Union, because of which there are, many hundred thousands living in, particularly in place, particularly older immigrants living in countries like Spain or France,
So the EU could
where
have retaliatory measures and restrict their movement.
yes, exactly, or restrict access to healthcare, meaning that they may well have to come home or decide to come home, thereby sort of increasing the burden on services in the UK.
So if is it possible then sort of looking at Johnson's so far short-lived leadership, is it possible that he could also end up being a short-lived prime minister in general? Is he facing enough opposition? And I say this from the perspective of someone who doesn't quite understand how the UK system works, because it's very different from the US's and complicated and much more dynamic than the US's. But is it possible that Johnson could be a very short-lived prime minister?
So, what looks likely when Parliament returns in early September is that there'll be some kind of vote of no confidence, where Parliament declares that it essentially that it doesn't have confidence in Boris Johnson's ability to command a majority. It will require Conservative Conservative MPs voting against the government, but some Remain supporting MPs have indicated that they're likely to do so. What would happen then is that there's a 14-day period where an alternative government, efforts are made to form an alternative government. If that alternative government isn't formed, then there's a general election. So what you could see emerging could be some kind of government of national unity, whether it's led by Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the Labour Party, or whether it's led by a kind of grandee of Parliament, a much older, much more established MP who has no real personal ambition, but is seen in the country as somebody who could unite the Parliament together. Somebody like Kenneth Clarke, sort of well-respected pro-European Conservative MP, or somebody like Margaret Hodge, a very well-respected Labour MP, that they would try and forge a government together and then try and come up with some kind of solution, whether it be revoking Article 50, having another referendum, and so forth.
Is it possible that a general election could take place just weeks before the Brexit deadline of October 31st, which I imagine would be 2 or 3 very politically chaotic weeks?
Yes, it's entirely possible. If the government fell in mid-September, it's feasible for there to be an election a week or two before Brexit. It's possible an election could be held afterwards. However, there is a convention under which changes to the status quo cannot occur under during a general election. The problem is, what is the status quo? Is it Britain remaining in the European Union, or Britain progressing through the process of leaving the European Union? That would be something, I think, for the courts to
Wow.
decide. Whether they want to or not is a different question.
Well, Luke, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time, and we might have to have you back on the show in October. Thanks so much.
Great, thank you very much. Okay, thanks so much. Bye-bye.
My guest has been Luke Reeder. He teaches in the Department of History at Case Western University in Cleveland, Ohio. And we've been discussing the latest on Brexit and Prime Minister Boris Johnson's negotiations. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.